Chapter 17, Toronto, 1936. On January 7th, 1936, images of the Dion Quints appeared in newspapers, not gallivanting on their playground or opening presents from Santa, but under the watchful eye of Dr. Defoe, dressed in scrubs, attending to each of the girls one at a time. Assisted by another doctor and nurse, Dr. Defoe was taking a bold step. While much of North America had thumbed their nose at the aluminum-containing diphtheria injection, Defoe had decided to demonstrate his faith in the new shot by administering it not once, but three times, to all of the Dion Quints. One by one, and with a photographer at the ready, the 18-month-old sleeves were rolled up, steadied by the assistant, and held in place as Dr. Defoe personally administered the injections. It is unlikely he had first tried the injection on himself or even asked the girl's parents for permission, but with the continued threat of diphtheria a real possibility, he knew the profound effect this gesture was likely to have. By publicly putting the world's five most important toddlers under the needle, Defoe knew images and stories about the procedure would travel around the world. In Toronto, where fascination of the girls and respect for Dr. Defoe was at its peak, the effect was instantaneous. Within days, clinics registered their highest ever attendance and were flooded with parents who had previously refused the shot. Public health officials were elated, one of them cheekily admitting, "I think that this is the best propaganda for toxoiding I ever saw." Defoe doubled down, pronouncing the new diphtheria shot so crucial to the girls' health that he had insisted they receive it before the only other shot children might receive at the time, the smallpox vaccine. In the United States, accounts of the procedure were retold with breathless wonder and hyperbole. Quote, "By the time the third treatment came around, just before Christmas, it had become a game, and all five of the little girls chattered and laughed, watching every move of the doctor's practiced hands as they moved swiftly and surely in sterilizing and adjusting the hypodermic needle. When the sun, shining brightly through the windows, glittered on the shiny instruments, the babies shouted and gurgled with glee." End quote. Due to an abundance of caution, Defoe had actually started the injections in November, months earlier. As the head of essentially the world's most famous child-rearing experiment, the scrutiny he faced was immense. His reputation as the world's consummate children's physician depended on the perpetual health of the quintuplets, whose every cough, sniffle, and sneeze went under a global microscope. Like any doctor or parent of the day, he was certainly aware the previous diphtheria shot, with its risk of serum sickness, was capable of causing grave problems. Outside the nursery, adoring fans did what they could to chart the Dion's development. Even a fleck of white on the gums of one of the girls might spark worldwide speculation that teething had begun. Within the confines of the nursery, every detail of the girls' lives was dutifully logged by the nurses in charge of their care. They took careful notes on the girls' daily elimination routines and behaviors at mealtimes, checking off whether they had showed signs of cooperation, unfinished servings, refusals, or least desirable of all, plain old inattention. Whether it was due to the vaccine or not, one cannot say, but several of the girls seemed to develop issues shortly after. Marie was first, her eyes crossed, a condition for which her mother would humiliate her later on in life. In earlier pictures of the babies, for which there are hundreds, her eyes appeared to be perfectly straight, but soon after the shots had been given, a subtle change in alignment was evident. It wasn't just Marie. The eyes of Emily and Yvonne had also turned inward. Previous pictures depicted their eyes correctly aligned, but something had caused the muscles that innervated their ocular movement to weaken. These changes were subtle and probably went unnoticed by most, particularly for those more smitten with the girls' cute outfits and childish antics. Emily, however, began to experience another change, one that was not subtle. The nurses called them fainting spells, but they were most likely absence seizures, or what the French-speaking Canadians would have called petite mal. Absence seizures are typically mild, with no spasmodic movements of the body or face to give them away. Most people might mistake someone undergoing one of these episodes as being deep in thought or daydreaming, a delicate distinction one could miss without having seen it multiple times. For the nurses who spent every waking hour with the girls, it could not be missed. Something was wrong with Emily. They brought their concerns to the doctor, who was more troubled with the possibility of her condition becoming known outside the nursery, than the particular effects of a serious neurological problem. Defoe instructed them not to speak a word about it to anyone, lest the entire world begin asking questions about what had happened. Fortunately for both the doctor and his staff, Emily's troubles were subtle enough to escape detection from those who had driven to see them. Thankfully, Emily's other sisters were quick to adjust, accepting her condition as part of a normal childhood. An article from Life magazine described the various traits of each quint, details of which would soon begin to take on more significance. Quote, Emily Marie Jean Dion is the great Quinn clown. She not only does funny things like putting on Dr. Defoe's galoshes, but she has sense of humor enough to think that things she does are funny. Next to the smallest of the quints, she weighs 30 pounds, is 34 inches tall, has a narrower face than her round-faced sisters. Most people consider Emily the least good-looking. She was first to talk, is now the loudest laugher, most enthusiastic joiner of games. She is also the most mischievous. When she was a few months old, she tried the common baby trick of wailing loudly a few minutes after the nurse's lights went out. She kept this up a few days. When no one came to look at her, she shut up. End quote. Marie fared little better, as the author of the article proclaimed, quote, rumors that she is mentally backwards seem false. She is quieter than her sisters, more musical, and more ingenuous. The other Quins delight in playing on their resemblances to confuse visitors or nurses and avoid such nuisances as getting their noses wiped. Marie is innocent and obedient, doesn't try any tricks. The first to wake most mornings, she likes to lie cooing or singing to herself. End quote. Despite the troubling developments of Emily and Marie, it was clear Dr. Defoe's publicity stunt had worked. The world's preeminent physician had personally administered the immunization not once, but three times to the most delicate, important children in the world, and consequently, it was assumed by growing numbers of parents their children would also be kept safe. With the promise only a single shot was needed, the fear of serum sickness had been reduced to essentially zero. Mothers and fathers, eager to spare their children the grisly death of diphtheria, began to place their faith in the injection, just as Defoe had.